Welcome to the program. As the president this morning meets with the prime minister of Israel, certainly it brings to mind truly the reality of intractable conflict. The fact is that one in every 20 conflicts ends up grinding to a halt. That's fully 5%, not just to the diplomatic and political problems that we read about in the newspaper, but disputes and arguments from our everyday lives as well. Once we get pulled into these conflicts, they become self-perpetuating, and it becomes nearly impossible to escape the velocity of the problems themselves. How can we find a way out? How can we deal with those problems in which we are completely ensnared? We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Dr. Peter Coleman. He's an associate professor of psychology and education at Columbia University. He is the director of the International Center for Cooperation, Conflict Resolution, and on the faculty of the Earth Institute at Columbia. It is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his new work, The 5%, Finding Solutions to Seemingly Impossible Conflicts. Peter Coleman, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
It's good to have you here. One of the things you talk about is that so many of these large, intractable problems, whether they're interpersonal or whether they're global, don't start out as big problems. They start out as many small problems that build on themselves.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the trick with these things is it's hard to know what can evolve into something as long-term and destructive as this. For example, I worked as a community mediator for New York State for years, and I remember a case that had started between neighbors where there was the sap of a tree of one neighbor dripping on the paint of the car of another neighbor, and that is what triggered it. But by the time it had come, you know, it had been referred through the police to community mediation, they had really experienced at that point almost 2 years of increasingly hostile and even violent encounters between the neighbors. And again, it had started with something, you know, off-putting but relatively benign. But had grown and grown over time, and then other people had gotten involved, and other issues happened, and then how each person responded to it, contributed to it, and eventually these things can kind of feed each other and grow into something that we think is just different and then just sort of operates in a different way.
In trying to figure out those ways to solve these problems, how important is it to know the history, to understand the evolution of how a problem got to be what it is?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's both critical to understand it. It's always very important to have what we would call sort of local information about any particular conflict. I mean, at one level, what we believe is that what's happening to each of these situations, each of these types of conflict, is very basic and very similar. So there's something about the dynamics of these things that are similar across situations, and so understanding that gives you sort of general insight to all different types of conflict. But if you are to actually go in and work with a conflict and try to make things better, reduce the hostilities, then it's critical that you have a sense of where, you know, how long has it gone, who's been involved, what's been tried in the past, and who, you know, more importantly, who has been able to do useful, constructive things between the parties in the past, because typically it's those people that have real insight to what is possible right now and how to start to try to move these things into a different direction. So that kind of awareness and information of a specific situation is critical if you're going to go in and actually do work in that situation. But at a more sort of general level, we think we can understand these things, whether they're happening, you know, in families or between neighbors or in the Middle East, at a basic level in terms of their dynamics.
In a way, it seems like it should be easier to deconstruct them, understanding what the history is, but it doesn't quite work like that. It doesn't go backwards in the same way.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when we think about these things as complex systems, and the interesting thing about all complex systems, which include, of course, our brain and how we understand things and the universe and how that operates, but one of the interesting things about all complex systems are that you can't really predict what will happen in a complex system. You can't say, well, if I do this, we will see that, because there are too many things that are affecting it. So it's always hard to predict before the fact what any kind of intervention will do, but you can sometimes kind of trace it back and say, well, because of these things and because this happened now, we can see that this is the outcome. So you can look backwards and sort of make sense of what's happening right now, but it doesn't really help you in terms of how to move things forward, because these are very unpredictable systems in a way.
There is a school of thought that says that when you have this kind of intractable problem, particularly one that's gone on for a long time, that oftentimes the solution to it is to create a larger problem, which is more immediate and therefore more solvable as a way to work back.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. I mean, I think that there is an element of truth to that. One of the best ways to unite enemies is to give them a third enemy,
right.
To give them a broader enemy. And so that is a way to unite people, and I think that we see that happen around natural disasters. You know, you saw in the tsunami that happened a couple of years back, that warring ethnic groups that were, you know, on the verge of attacking each other at the time would actually reconcile for a time, put down their arms, and work together to salvage the community. But then after a time, the conflict returns. So there is some truth to that idea that larger problems can help. But, I think that it's tricky to identify simple solutions to any of these problems, because that the introduction of another problem, of course, will have its own consequences,
right.
And its own pattern, and so you may be, in the long run, making things worse and not better.
One of the things you talk about is that in your work, trying to get to the essence of problems, really what you found is that there are 56 or 57 of these essences of problems.
Right. Right. Well, so, you know, I was trained as a social psychologist, and we're trained to try to, you know, break things down and understand their sort of basic components, and so that's what I was doing originally as I approached trying to understand these, you know, more intractable long-term conflicts. And what I found in the literature is that there were, depending on who you read or what you read, there were many answers as to what was the essence of the problem. People would say, well, these are conflicts that become about identity. You know, it really becomes about that you're a Palestinian and not an Israeli, and that's really what it's organized around. Or others would say, no, it's really about trauma, that there's been untreated trauma sometimes for generations, and that's really what's driving the conflict. Or people would say, no, it's about corruption. It's really all about money and control, and they're not talking about those issues, and they're below the radar, and that's really what's driving this. So there were all these rational, reasonable answers to what are the essence to these problems. But what we found ultimately is that, you know, there were many pieces that we understood, but that didn't give us real insight generally into why these things seem to never end. And so what we had to understand is not any one or two or three pieces of these problems, but really how they kind of come together in some fashion and start to feed on each other and support each other and become this kind of mass of evolving problem sets that become unresponsive to change, because if you deal with or address any one or two, three pieces, it may affect those pieces, but it may exacerbate other problems. And so any type of intervention that's simple and that's not mindful of the kind of set of problems that you're dealing with can, in fact, make matters worse.
In trying to solve these problems, then, is there a kind of map one tries to create initially based upon these 56 different factors?
Well, what we do when we work in any kind of specific situation, for example, I was just recently working with a group of orchestras that were involved in a protracted labor dispute. And it was a dispute that had gotten threatening and even violent at some point. And they were trying to make sense of this problem. And, of course, the management would see labor as the problem and labor would see management as the problem. And so what we did is try to, again, work with a way of helping them see that there are multiple problems here, there are multiple issues, this does have a history, a long history. It's taking place at a certain time when unions in the United States are under attack by certain entities. And so there's a context to this that really helps make this feel so impossible. And having the disputants, the individuals involved in these types of conflicts, having them just to start to unpack what different things are involved, in and of itself just makes a difference. It helps them to start to see, well, it's not just the sort of evil, ill-intentioned other, but there are other things that are involved here, and it's useful to have a sense of that. So we use that kind of mapping exercise. It can be really just something that we walk people through. You know, what are the various aspects and how do they affect each other? We use those things to help people start to unpack not only the kind of multiple sources of the problem that they face, but then also we ask them, well, why doesn't it get worse? What helps here? Are there people that are still able to talk to each other across these divides? Are there reasonable things that are happening? Where is your sense of possibility in this? And having people start to identify those, almost like identifying antibodies in a system, you know, what are the things that are working to make the system more healthy, that really gives them a sense of possibility and hope that, in fact, despite the fact that there's all this animosity, you do see that there's good things going on.
How important is timing and context? Because it does seem there are some problems that are just not going to be solved at a certain point, that it's going to take time before the parties can really address some of the issues.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, timing, I think, is critical. On the one hand, I back off of statements around sort of ripeness of conflict and timing, because I do feel that conditions can be made to make conflicts more resolvable. So it's not that we just have to really wait for circumstances to present themselves. However, what we do find is that, you know, timing is critical. Understanding sort of the short-term effects and long-term effects of these problems are critical. Like, one of the more interesting things that has been found in research in the international domain on these is that oftentimes you'll see these types of conflicts in the international domain start somewhere approximately around 10 years after there's been some major political shock to a system. So you have a world war, or you have a civil war in a local country or something like that, and then you don't see immediate effects, but down the road, say 5, 6, 10 years, you'll see radical changes. So it's interesting to me that right now you see in the Arab Spring unfolding, and the Arab Spring seems to be occurring approximately 10 years after 9/11 and 10 years after the United States went into Afghanistan and Iraq. So those were major shocks to the system 10 years ago, and one way to think about what's happening now is you're seeing the effects of that kind of shakeup that happened a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding how these types of changes happen over time is really important. We think it's one of the most critical things that oftentimes we misunderstand. You know, we like to think in terms of sort of, you know, you go in, you bring in peacekeepers, and you'll foster peace. Well, it may not be that simple. It may be that you create certain conditions, and then over years those conditions lend themselves to a different kind of process or a different kind of dynamic, and then you see peace emerge. But it's never as sort of, you know, short-term or never works in sort of simple cause and effect ways.
The other aspect that you talk about that is hard to tease out of these situations is the role that emotion plays.
Yeah, emotion's critical. And it's interesting, in my field of conflict resolution, you know, we recognize emotion, but typically what we've said to people is, you know, if you're in a difficult negotiation with your partner or with someone at work, you know, if you're feeling emotional, stop, back off, you know, give it time, let it pass, and then come back and be rational again. And that's, you know, useful advice for many conflicts, but when the conflicts are really rooted in feelings of hate and enmity and loyalty to your group and loyalty to people who've perished in the past, then you can't really say to people, well, wait till that passes and then we'll deal with this in a more rational way. We really have to understand how emotions that sort of can build up over time really establish sort of the context that influences how we understand things. If we have a powerfully negative emotions about another individual or a group of people, then really anything we think about them or anything we see them do, even if they're well-intentioned gestures by the other side, we interpret them at a sort of very gut level in negative terms. This is an interesting research by a man named John Gottman who does research on marital conflict and divorce. And they found that, you know, particularly around marital conflicts, emotions are critical. And that you need to have a very strong, positive emotional basis in a marriage in order to be able to have conflicts be useful for you, you know, so that you can learn from them and sort of move on from them. But if you have almost even a balanced ratio of, you know, half the time negative experiences and half the time positive experiences, the negative will overwhelm and eventually will sort of destroy the relationship, and they will end up in divorce. So you need a very strong, they even say a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative emotions in a marriage context in order for conflicts to be useful, constructive forces in the relationship.
In that sense, it's not dissimilar from other situations where you're looking to a reservoir of goodwill to have some value as the parties try to negotiate.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that is a common theme. But what's interesting is what we think is that in long-term conflicts where you have clearly a lot of animosity, frustration, rage, enmity between the parties, there is sometimes a history of relationships between them that precedes the conflict where there was a sort of a reservoir of positivity. And you may not have any conscious sense of that. You may not be aware of that, because really what you're paying attention to is how threatening they are, how difficult they are, how evil they seem to be. But there may be what we call kind of latent pockets of emotional experiences for these other parties that can be tapped into. They're either pre-existing because so this is what was seen in the relationships between Poland and the Ukraine. You know, they had long-term, about 50 years of hostile relations post-World War II, because both sides had committed atrocities during World War II and blamed the other side. And so there was this deep sense of animosity. But then what you saw during the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine a few years ago is you saw a quick flip in the feelings of the Poles for the Ukrainians. You suddenly see this sense of solidarity and joy in their revolution. And that comes from somewhere, and we believe that that comes from the fact that they've had relations between these peoples and between these countries for centuries that preceded World War II, and so they had lived for years with a sense of trade and with a sense of camaraderie with their neighbors before the war. And that was latent for a time, but then was sort of recaptured when the Orange Revolution occurred.
How important is it for a third party to be involved in any kind of successful negotiations?
Well, again, it depends. So what we write about, again, is the sort of 5% of conflicts, and that term comes from some work in the international domain where they've looked over 200 years and have identified that approximately 5% of international conflicts seem to endure. They seem to go on for 20, 30 years, sometimes centuries, but 95% of them don't. And so what I would say is that the vast majority of conflicts, I believe, people can work through, people can talk through, people can negotiate themselves, and when that doesn't work, then you need to start to work with third parties. With the 5%, with the particularly difficult, long-term, you know, destructive conflicts that they are, it does oftentimes require the assistance of other people to help make sense. Now, it may be that these third parties are not outsiders, you know, that it may be that the United States isn't the best entity to step into the Middle East and try to intervene. It may be that those third parties are some members of the community that are respected by both sides, and so they again intimately understand the situation, they are respected by the parties, and they can have an influence on a process that an outside third party may not be able to have. So when things can't be negotiated, and there have been good faith attempts at that, then I think third parties are necessary and very helpful.
Are there specific areas that you have found that really precipitate some of these 5% of conflicts, be they religious, be they about property, be they interpersonal? Are there specific issues that tend to be more than others the source of these intractable conflicts?
Well, there are other people that have identified conflicts around moral conflicts, you know, where people have very different worldviews about how people should behave and how people should treat each other. So issues, for example, around abortion, pro-life and pro-choice communities. Sometimes there are ideological issues, religious issues, particularly when religion comes to a place of more fanaticism or intolerance of other religions. Conflicts over power. Power and control, and conflicts over very scarce and important resources. Those those kinds of issues tend to frequently be involved in these problems. But again, what we've found is that, of course, there are a lot of scarce resource conflicts in this world that are resolved constructively, and there are religious communities that live together in harmony, and there are moral differences with the pro-life, pro-choice communities all around this country, where they're able to, again, respect the fact that they differ fundamentally in their beliefs, but are not willing to engage violently or in more destructive ways. So most conflicts are able to do that. So even though some of these issues that I mentioned, moral conflicts, conflicts over power, scarce resources, can be associated with these things, they're not always. It really requires, you know, sort of what we call a perfect storm, a certain constellation of things coming together around those issues that make them intractable.
One of the problems with those moral issues is that they immediately lend themselves to good versus evil, which really is part of what creates intractable kinds of problems.
Yeah, they do collapse. I mean, that's one of the ironies we think of these types of conflicts is what tends to happen over time is the conflicts become more and more complicated because as they continue, whether it's a pro-life, pro-choice conflict within a community over a specific event, eventually you get more and more people involved, there are other issues involved, and it becomes more complicated, but as it becomes more complicated sort of on the ground, it is seen by the parties that are involved as very simple. As you know, they're the problem. We're victims of their insanity, and they're the drivers of the conflict. So even though it becomes much more complex, it's seen as very fundamentally simple, as in sort of us-them terms.
Right. We talked about the emotional aspect of it. One of the other things you talk about is this idea of not to trust your senses necessarily in these conflict negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, what we find is that the dynamics of these conflicts are very powerful and sometimes unseen and not particularly understood. There are norms that have been passed on to certain groups and individuals. There are beliefs, and we sort of accept them as truths. And so our gut will be telling us, this is an evil person, don't trust them. And that comes from, again, a variety of different things. And these are very constraining forces that really limit our ability to see or understand what's possible in a situation. So, you know, what we suggest is that what I wanted to refer to a quote by Nelson Mandela, which I think is a fantastic quote that captures sort of this idea. He says that one effect of sustained conflict is to narrow our vision of what is possible. But time and again, conflicts are resolved through shifts that were unimaginable at the start. And that is a basic dynamic that we think that happens here, is that as people live in these conflicts for longer and longer periods of time, as they become more threatening and important to them, their understanding of the problem becomes very simple and very rigid, and it's difficult to introduce a sense of possibility or a way out when there's so much certainty and rigidity in the perception of the other and the perception of you and your group.
Because what happens in some cases is that the conflict becomes the norm, that people are defined or institutions are defined by that very conflict.
Absolutely. And it happens at all levels. It happens in how history is taught. There's a great NGO that assesses the content of history books. It originally started in the Middle East, and now they work in multiple conflict zones. And what they do is they take a hard look at how are children being taught the history of the country and the history of the people and the history of the conflict, and is it relatively nuanced, or is it really biased and therefore feeding into a sense of resentment that will perpetuate this conflict over multiple generations? So it happens in newspaper accounts, it happens in, you know, textbook accounts, it happens in what comes through your family and your community about what you should believe, what you shouldn't believe. And it really does become, as you say, normal. It becomes your life. It becomes your set of belief in how the world works. And those are very difficult things to shake and to change. But they do change, and they can change. One of the more interesting studies that's happened in this area is a project by a man named Varshney, who went into India, and he said, you know, let's look at where the Muslim-Hindu violence has happened in India, because there are Muslim and Hindu communities all over the country, but the violence is only in certain areas, in certain cities and in certain rural areas. So he went and looked carefully at that, and what they found was that in those communities where you had Muslims and Hindus living near each other, they were sort of organized in very simple ways. You know, if you were Hindu, you would work with other Hindus, you'd worship with other Hindus, you'd play sports with other Hindus, you were in labor unions with them, and you never really crossed the boundaries. So you had people living together, but basically they only interacted with members of their own community and not members of the other community. So in those situations, when there was a conflict between a Muslim and a Hindu, it would quickly generate and escalate to violence because there was no sense of relationship with the other that could buffer that. But in the communities where you had, you know, sports teams that were interethnic and labor unions that were interethnic, then when there was a conflict that would take place between Muslims and Hindus, it was much harder to sort of simplify and vilify them, the other group, because you knew them, you worked with them. I know your brother-in-law. I've actually, you know, my sister is married to your cousin. It's difficult under those conditions to really simplify so quickly. And so that those kinds of structures in communities can actually provide sort of buffers to keep things from getting out of control.
Peter Coleman, his book is The 5%, Finding Solutions to Seemingly Impossible Conflicts. It's just out from Public Affairs. Peter, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.